Dr. Johnson, I guess.
I can say what I know about Creative School. They're working under a challenging circumstance, which is that the kids that they watch over are below the age of vaccines. And they've got, I don't know if it's accreditation required or just a professional responsibility to change the way they do business. And they've been doing that, as I'm sure you know. Good morning, Bridget, I see. And I'm sure you know they've changed business for this whole past year because of that, right? Isolating one room from another room and all of that. So they don't end up in a position of having to shut the whole facility down if one kid ends up testing positive or even ill. So I haven't heard for certain if they're going to continue reduced hours this fall, but I think they're likely to, for the reason I just said, that they're struggling with this challenge to how they do business. Charlie, do you know for sure if their hours are going to be down?
Well, they on their website, they're hoping to keep that updated with additional information, but without being able to vaccinate the children, they're not able to create new rooms out of nowhere. And they have to keep the social distancing and the mask wearing. So without additional resources, there's no way to make that work. You can't add more teachers effectively because you have to keep them in the pod so you don't cross-transmit. So I guess they've had a very, very small number of cases and they were able to isolate them all in one pod. And if you start having teachers move from room to room, which is what they did before the pandemic, then you risk just undoing the entire project.
Bridget has a question.
May I ask questions? Is it okay if I make a statement or just ask questions about this? So, you know, I think, you know, one of the things I want to say is, you know, I kind of feel like there are lots of things that we can do, you know, aside from just adding teachers or adding children. At the same time, I do think, you know, that, you know, there could be more children in the classes. I think it could be possible. I'm not sure if that's what the parents want. There are no regulations or rules that I can find that are requiring them to keep the class sizes low. The class sizes were always in different structures in different rooms throughout the Creative School if you've been there. And so the class sizes within those rooms are lower. And so, you know, raising the size of classes, you know, could be a possibility. Just a couple of weeks ago, all the kids got sick across pods. It wasn't COVID, but it was a cold of some sort. So, you know, the pods are maybe not working as effectively as they could or should. And COVID doesn't transmit through children as much as maybe some other things. At least that's how my doctor has responded. But I think, you know, the thing is that it's impacting our faculty really greatly, that and students and staff that all work there. My research has been impacted dramatically over the past year, but I have the ability to, you know, sacrifice my research. Staff who are there don't have that ability. A lot of them have been called back full time, and you may say, well, then just go find another daycare. I looked for 3 weeks at other daycares. They don't compare to this daycare. They don't compare to where my daughter's been since she was 6 months old. She has the teachers and the friends that she loves and this kind of tumultuous time to take her away from that. You know, this is something that is really impacting all of us and still continues to. So, you know, I'm having to look for extra childcare to take care of it, paying extra money out of pockets, $600 to $750 extra dollars a month. I have no emergency savings in a time that's full of emergencies, you know, all of these things. And students have even less flexibility than I do as a faculty member to be able to find somewhere else or pay more money or do things like that. So, you know, my question is, what can we do about this? I feel like we have a lot of smart people here on this campus who could get together to creatively look for other solutions that could tackle this problem. You know, creating a task force, perhaps, of people of saying, you know, how do we confront this? you know, what can be done about it. As far as I know, the Creative School is an ERCCD, an Educational Research Center for Child Development, which means that by law, they're required to have a advisory board. And there was one before COVID, and I'm not sure what's happened. I'm going to put the link to the law here in the chat and, you know, the what they say about the composition of the advisory board. You know, if not an advisory board, then maybe a task force. If they're not an ERCCD, maybe they're not required anymore to have this bylaw. But to have people who are focused on confronting this problem, and I can just give you a couple of suggestions from my own point of view here of, you know, in the fall, ask all of your faculty and students, how are you still being impacted by childcare issues or other issues due to COVID? What can we do about that as a university? Allow us at the CSC, the parents, to use the teachers as babysitters. UCF has disallowed this practice, saying that it's a conflict of interest. I can't get my three-year-old to get into the car with someone that she doesn't know. I can't just hire a babysitter off the street and have them go pick up my child, right? That's extremely difficult. I used to use the teachers there, but then they said it was not allowed. So another avenue to having full-time childcare was taken away. You know, again, create a task force to help them fully reopen. Maybe they can't be given money or resources, but, you know, what can be done to do that? Also allow faculty, staff, and students to apply for stipends that can cover extra childcare. So we can have that money as a buffer to create emergency funds if we need it. Allow for faculty to apply for course and service releases that are impacted by this. Create research refresh grants for those heavily impacted by COVID for this or other various reasons. Lower standards for tenure and promotion for those that have been impacted. Because, you know, you can take an extra year to complete tenure, but is that really fair to have that time kind of where you're uncertain, where you're not having your raise or promotion, you know, compared to others who maybe were able to be more productive during this time because they didn't have burdens of childcare? So those are just a few of the things that I can think of offhand to possibly do to offset this, to help the faculty and the staff and the students that are impacted. And, you know, I think an advisory board or a task force could come up with a lot of others. So I'm sorry that was a lot of time, but I feel very strongly about this issue, obviously. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Bridget. Have they reached out at all? For suggestions from parents, or they just said what they're doing?
Bridget, now that I know what your questions really are, I'll talk to the Creative School leadership and I'll get back to you about something, okay? I wasn't sure what the scope of all your questions, but as I understand it right now, you can't put more children in the classroom. That's one of the major boundaries. I see Shelley with her hand up.
I just wanted to underscore, as Bridget went through a list of possibilities, and I'm sure there are even more in addition to that, that this is not just an issue of what can the Creative School do. I think Bridget is asking you all what you can do to people, especially women who are mothers, that have been heavily impacted and continue to be impacted by this. So please don't, I don't like the framing of this about parents versus Creative School. I think the larger issue that's being brought to the table is one that can be addressed in multiple ways beyond what the Creative School can do.
I recognize that, but we have an agenda for today and that was the stated item. So I'm trying to make sure that we move on to the next question. Brigitte, thank you so much. I will get back to you and I recognize that those are all also larger issues.
Okay, so if we can move on to the voting on candidates issue. I know Provost Johnson, you were around, I believe, when the Faculty Senate and the Provost at the time, who I think was Whitaker, debated this whole thing. And so as I understand it, the Faculty Senate is wishing to return to that issue in some capacity. And we're interested in you know, your views, if you could share them.
Sure. I'm happy to talk about it. You know, when I was Dean of Sciences, I sort of pressed a point of view that I still think is right, which is an really opposing voting for chairs. In fact, I opposed voting, faculty-wide voting for faculty hires as well, for a couple of reasons in each case. One is that it contradicts our university search rules, and you might reasonably enough say, but those rules can be changed, true enough. But as they're written now, it's really the recommendation of the search committee that's supposed to go to a hiring official. And it's actually for good reasons. I've never found it helpful to have votes. Here are our choices, 1, 2, 3, or whatever the number is, for filling any position, for a couple of reasons. One might be a reason that some faculty support it, which is that it's an attempt to tie the hiring official's hands. Say, do this thing. This is the thing we demand that you do. And I've always found that unhelpful. If the point is trying to make sure that the faculty viewpoint is well understood, my experience has been that asking people to explain their sense of strengths and weaknesses of candidates makes it extremely clear what the viewpoint is of people who are weighing in on a hiring, you know, faculty for the department chair, department for the hiring of a new faculty member, hiring a dean's or whatever. It becomes very clear what people are thinking, somewhat less by the survey than by the comments, right? It's less a numerical tally than it is what people have to say about candidates. And I think that feedback is extremely important. We don't do a good job hiring if people who don't understand a discipline, for instance, try to interject their judgment in place of those who do understand it. And then the other reason is a practical one as well, which is that, you know, sometimes things just don't work out with a number one hire, even if the hiring official agrees with, you know, let's say a department faculty, if it's a dean looking at a chair or if it's a chair looking at a faculty colleague, sometimes the number one doesn't work out for lots of reasons. They have demands that can't be met. They find some other opportunity that they prefer. They're in a couple searches at the same time, whatever. And it actually causes harm when people who come to be known and faculty don't keep secrets well as a second or third choice ends up being hired. It truly does harm when that person understands that they weren't really the desired one. And anyway, that's my belief. And so I've never supported having faculty voting on any searches, actually, not just chair searches. With chair searches, it's particularly weird, I think, in a unionized environment. I haven't really thought this through very carefully, but, you know, chairs are in the odd position, as you all know, of moving out of unit and becoming an aspect of the university's management instead of an in-unit member of the faculty during that time. And it crosses sort of a weird line. That doesn't really add to my sense about whether the goodness or badness of this. I just acknowledge it's a little odder yet in that context. So that's my thinking about it, Robert. I'm sort of interested if y'all have things you'd like me to hear, to hear them. Mm-hmm. Right? Having a belief doesn't mean I hold those beliefs forever. This is what I have settled into over these last years.
Yeah, I mean, I think this came from, we've been having internal conversations about this issue and, excuse me, and we know that the Faculty Senate want to return to this, you know, I guess post-Whitaker, if you will. And, you know, we support the Faculty Senate and we're interested in what your reaction will be, which you eloquently gave us just now. So does anybody have any questions, follow up for Provost Johnson on this issue? Okay, let's move to the next one. I think this is really dear to our hearts, if not also to yours, Provost Johnson. And if I could just add to this, because we know we made this agenda a little while ago, but I think since we put this question to you, and we are interested to know what the university plans to do to support faculty, to stand up for faculty in regards to the bullying that's going on with state lawmakers. But I want to also bring the point out that the governor, as well as three high-profile Republicans in Tallahassee, have all said the individual SUS campuses are sites of indoctrination. And I think this levy is a really kind of unfair and malicious slander against us as professors, but also you as a provost and the president, as the president of the university. And I'm hoping, we all hope, that you and President Cartwright are going to defend yourselves in this. I mean, they're essentially saying you're not doing your job, and you know, you have faculty that are doing things they shouldn't be doing. You know, in that regard, I would like to know if there's going to be any defense of you as provost and you as president, in addition to defending the faculty in this regard.
Well, the first statement I ought to make is I strongly support the right and actually the obligation of faculty to teach what they believe is suitable based on their understanding of the theories and methods and evidence of their discipline, whether those things are popular or unpopular. And I think it's really important that I make that clear this summer as this stuff is in the air and faculty naturally enough get worried. You know, I teach physics, it's never an issue, frankly. But it's a real issue for, I'm sure, Robert, for you as a historian and for others.
Can I interrupt you quick? I've actually fielded concerns from biologists and chemists who are afraid of this, who like you, are teaching in the hard sciences, but fear this kind of legislation come after them.
Yeah, what I should say, you know, it's not that it never happened during my time of teaching, but it's rare, right? We will teach things, you know, as a matter of fact, that some of our students don't believe, for example, for reasons of religious belief. But we seldom challenge people's identity in a way that can happen in humanities or social sciences, right? When you learn aspects of your country's history that change, that ask you to rethink your understanding of your own country, your own society. You know this. This can be really hard on a young person, but it's one of our duties. It's not a duty to change young people to think like us, but it is one of our duties to teach what we have come to understand and believe, as I said, based on the methods and theories and evidences of our own discipline. And I always frame it that way because, so let me just say again, yes, we strongly support, I do and the president does, faculty continuing to do this thing. And we will try to make that clear so that faculty at least know that they're supported by their own university. I always say it the way I just did, this idea of methods and theories and evidence of your own discipline, because as I know you all know, there's a professional responsibility, right? Academic freedom is real. It doesn't protect every stupid thing a faculty member can say in the classroom. And I said that word on purpose too, right? We've had a faculty member tell students, you know, I won't write you a letter of recommendation if you vote for Donald Trump. And that was a stupid thing to say. That's violating their professional responsibility. It's abusing their power in the classroom. And that, you know, we wrote a letter of reprimand or something to that faculty member saying, don't do this thing. So academic freedom comes with responsibility to do the job. I actually think we have a remarkably able faculty. It always struck me as dean of sciences that we had people teaching, not, you know, in the social sciences side, very, very seldom in biology, chemistry, physics, or mathematics, or statistics, but quite often in all of the social sciences, people teaching things that are really hard to learn, you know, about inequities, about what role race has played in American history and the development of our government, you know, understanding the criminal justice system and systemic differences of treatment between people of different races. You know, this stuff is real, and it's our faculty's duty to teach it. It always struck me as remarkable how relatively few complaints we got from students who didn't want to hear it. And I think that's because our faculty do a really good job. You know, in U.S. history, I don't need to tell you this, and there's always this pendulum, there's always this some tendency towards know-nothingism in the in the body politic, I guess. And sometimes people get stirred up to dislike universities or pointy-headed intellectuals or whatever it is. And I guess we're back in another one of those times. The way you framed your question now, to get back to it exactly, actually isn't a framing that's helpful as far as I can tell. And I'll say what I think, and maybe you'll help me see it differently. It's not important that I defend myself or that the president defend himself. When we battle with legislators, we lose. It's our job to protect the faculty, the students, and the institution. And that means I'm going to always frame what we're talking about in that language, the duty and obligation of our faculty to do the things I said, teach things that are unpopular, that are the, whether they're minority views or majority views in their discipline, you know, our faculty need to do what they believe is intellectually. Well,
President, Provost Johnson, to go back to the actual question was whether you, as the provost or UCF as an institution, or the president as the president, will release a statement of support. That's what we're trying to get at.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I said that a little bit fast on the way by. I haven't done it this summer. I'll do it, and I'll do it stronger as fall approaches, because people need to hear the defense. I can't, and this is a true statement, I cannot influence the thinking of our legislators. They're not interested in the viewpoint of their university leadership, I suspect. They have their beliefs and they have their political positions. So what we need to do is continue to emphasize what our obligation is as a university, and our faculty need to hear that we back them in that. So yes, sir. That is going to happen, but it won't be about us defending the president or the provost. It doesn't, and it frankly matter what they think of us. It matters that the faculty are able to do their jobs.
Okay. Anybody have any follow-up questions for Provost Johnson? Shelley?
A quick question. What is your sense of where the Board of Trustees stands on all this?
It's a good question. I haven't really heard them talk about it. That's a really good question. I've watched our boards of trustees over time, and now I'm a little bit paying more attention to the Board of Governors. And my sense has always been that people who accept these jobs start off with, call it preconceptions. Prejudice is too strong a word. Preconceptions about how they think universities operate, but they really quickly learn about the place and how it runs. I mean, they really do take these jobs, they don't get paid anything, and it takes a lot of effort. They take them because they want the universities to do a good job. And relatively few of them are adamant that things are different than you and I think they actually are on the ground. So we'll see. I mean, this is a lot of new legislation that just came out fast. And I will learn more in this coming fall about what they think. And when I speak with them, I talk the way I just did with you. And so does the president. They need to hear from us. This is how this university operates and should operate for us to be doing our duty to our students, to society. So it's not just we try not to frame it just as a matter of rights, but as a matter of sort of responsibility, so that we're actually doing our job as we should do it. And we'll find out, Shelley, if they hassle us. This gets right to the heart of what we do. This isn't like disagreeing over how you spend some money. This is what we are. And this is the reason universities exist. I don't know what we are without this. What's a provost who doesn't defend this, right? An opportunist or something. It's really important for us to continue to say that, whether every member of a board, trustees or governors, or every one of our political leaders or people throughout the state agree with us or not. We just have to. We don't always frame that defense in a way that our faculty want us to. Sometimes there's a desire that we frame it in a way which is rejecting, sort of like what Robert just said. And this is not a criticism, Robert. In a conversation like this, it's completely reasonable to use the language that you did. We can actually do the institution, our faculty and students, harm by framing this as a fight with our political leadership. When we do that, we lose. When instead we say, here is our responsibility as we understand it, and continue to defend our faculty in executing that responsibility, then I believe we're doing what we must do for you, for our students, and in an appropriate framing of how we respond to them. But this is one of the weirdest things, is that I feel a little less free as a provost just to be blunt spoken about some of this than I did as a faculty member. And it's not because of my job, it's because of the harm it can do to the institution if we frame things poorly.
But just, I mean, if I could follow up here, Provost Jones, I hear what you're saying, but when we have politicians in Tallahassee who are spoiling for a fight, and in our responses, we do not fight, I'm not sure that is effective. Just my opinion.
Oh, I hear you loud and clear, and I understand that, actually. One of the great things about this business is, for me personally, is I've sincerely believed different things at different times in my time going through higher ed. Who can carry out that fight is a good question.
Okay, any final follow-up here? Okay, let's move on. So we're all familiar with the legislation involved in the high-risk countries issue and the disclosure and what you have to do by part of Florida statute. But what we're interested in is if there's anything you can do in your capacity to mitigate some of the harm and the rhetoric that is coming down from Tallahassee onto UCF.
Yeah, there's sort of two different things. There's the recent legislation, which you're referring to. And there's also been, over a couple of years, an increasing set of responsibilities and requirements coming out of federal agencies, which we depend on, not just for research grants, but for student financial aid and all of that, which require us to behave in similar, you know, skeptical fashion about institutions in countries of concern. So the legislation, you know, certainly highlights the issue, but it's not just the legislation that we're having to deal with. We and everybody else in the SUS has moved really fast to try to get policies in place that comply with legislation, because it came effective 12 days ago. There was very little time to do it. And I think where we'll start off is with a pretty strong concern and skepticism about accepting gifts and grants. That's the easy part, from countries of concern and certain institutions with them. That's actually easy, because those are these discrete moments and they don't happen very often. A lot harder is the requirement that we investigate people who might become involved with research. That's by far the hardest part of this whole thing, because the law says that we have to do it. I think it's before we interview them. And that's really complicated. It can include graduate students from China, right, who are entering PhD programs, not just faculty from other countries who were contemplated hiring. So we've added a couple staff. Yeah, I'm not even sure which offices they're in, to help carry that out. So mitigate, the best I can say is try to give the tools so that we can continue to, you know, look reasonably at applicants from countries like China, whether for faculty jobs or for graduate student positions, where there's enough support for the departments that at least they don't have to throw their hands up in despair and say, we can't do it because we can't comply with the law. We're going to try to make it possible for people to do this in a way that complies with the law. But I think we'll start off imperfect this year because of the need to get something up in place in a real hurry that complied with the law, and we'll learn in the course of the year and probably be better at it a year from now and going forward.
So, I mean, you spoke a lot about people coming into UCF? What about the faculty who are here that might be targets of this, or the law might target? I mean, are you thinking about speaking to them in any way to let them know they're appreciated and they're, you know, because this law really does. I mean, at least I'm getting emails from people in the sciences and the engineering who are really concerned about this law and how they'll be treated with this law in come the fall.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's a good question. I don't want to say empty words that, you know, we love you, don't worry. So the real question is, what do folks need to hear? Because, I mean, you know, part of it just sounds so chilly and unhelpful. The short answer is, you know, if you're compliant with the legislation, it's easy to, just, it's easy not to be in trouble. We've had one or two, I'm not sure the number of faculty who were in fact, I mean, I should back up and say, look, this is based on a reality, which is it really is true that there's been a lot of effort to steal intellectual property from universities and businesses in the U.S. It's not just, you know, a politically motivated statement. It's in fact a truth that people on both sides of the aisle, certainly in D.C., believe. And we've had an experience with that. You know, we've had a faculty member who was getting grants for some work from the U.S. and simultaneously from China. And the person took off to China, you know, left their, abandoned their job here when it started to become clear. And I don't believe it was a case of persecution and they fled in fear. I actually believe it was somebody who was fleeing because they'd been discovered. Woof. You know, that's an unpleasant circumstance. So the best thing is to make sure people know what they can and cannot do. And the challenge with that is that it always sounds like a threat when you tell people, here are the things that are permissible and here are the things that are not. And it's, you know, MJ Swallow, when he was vice president of research, I won't use his language, it was just mildly crude. He would say, the purpose of trying to get people to, you know, pay attention to the requirements and to be compliant, pay attention to conflict of interest and all of that. And so an attaboy doesn't turn into an problem. And we don't, there's not much we can do about people who are crooks, right? There are crooks in all facets of society. What we want to do is to help our faculty who are trying to just do a decent job and live a decent life avoid being in a circumstance where they get burned inadvertently. And I think that really includes some education, Robert. We can say formally we've done that by all the lists of do's and do nots in our conflict of interest and other policies, but those are chilly and hard to follow. So it's a good question. How can we best help people feel confident that they're doing things right and aren't therefore likely to be, you know, a victim inadvertently of these changes? I'm not sure I have a great wisdom right now, but it's an excellent point.
Does anybody have any follow-up?
I think we better think about that because our message, you know, we send these messages, but it's like, do the right thing. And that's actually sort of not the point. It's please do the right things so we can keep us all, keep you out of trouble. So it's a communication question. Let me ponder that, Robert. See if we can, what we can do better.
I just like, you know, what I think we're trying to pass along here, there's a great deal of anxiety on the parts of the people who are impacted by this legislation that you should be aware of. And I think, you know, I think a vast majority of them are not, you know, in the category that you described earlier, but are well-meaning people who are trying to do their work.
I agree completely. Hey, Claudia.
Hey, I just wanted to add that it's certainly not just the people who may be targeted because they are Chinese or they're Iranian or they're in the current category of people of concern. It's others as well. I mean, I find this a chilling situation because, as you said, there are historical precedents of these sort of things happening. And much like what we talked about earlier in terms of critical race theory and the kind of, you know, speechifying that goes on by politicians, this is creating a chilling effect, not just on those people who are currently targeted, but
on the rest of us too, because, you know, next round it's going to be somebody else. And so I think how we deal with this is important to all of us, not just the particular groups of people currently on the list of the evil empire or whatever we have in terms of language right now.
Help me out a little bit. I mean, the chilling effect I've been worried about might not be the same thing you just said. Yes, there's this individual concern that I was responding to. I've been afraid we're going to go back to something a little bit like the Cold War, where scholars, for example, in the Soviet Union and the Western world couldn't really work together. And sometimes it was for good reasons, right? Meaning, you know, I'm a physicist. If I was working, which I never did, on matters associated with nuclear weaponry, I could assume that I wouldn't be able to work with my counterparts anywhere. But it really went much further than that. It went across a lot, much of scholarship. So I've been worried about a rebound of that, but I think you're talking about something else.
Well, I'm talking about certain individuals being directly impacted because of who they are and the kind of work they're doing. But I'm also talking in terms of the chilling effect about one of the things that happens is self-censorship, right? In terms of both the critical race theory stuff and also some of these things. So it's about faculty avoiding teaching certain things or, for example, in a job search, right? When the new thing came out about all the background checks we're going to have to allegedly do before we can even talk to somebody from these various countries. I've run the two last searches in Islamic studies, right? I mean, I there's no way I could do a decent job sorting through candidates with those requirements on the books, right? I can't even talk to half of the candidates before doing background checks. And if you want to send a signal to potential colleagues, like, oh no, we got to do background check first, that's a real problem. And so what does that mean for people in those positions? Are they just going to avoid even looking at people like that? Are they going to avoid looking at grant opportunities or collaborations, for example, particularly in intercultural or international contexts? So it has a chilling effect on, in the sense of not just people who are directly targeted because of their identity or work, but also others in terms of partnership, in terms of what they sort of self-censor or don't talk about or leave out as possibilities.
Yeah, this is something that's very particular to Florida. You know, most of what I was talking about is national, but this interference with hiring is a real problem. You know, that's not gonna help Florida. It's going to harm our universities if it continues at the same level for too long for the reasons you said. You know, if we become a place that people don't want to come to work because people like them are undesirable in the state, or because other people that they care about are undesirable in this state, then we end up definitely worse off. No argument there.
No, and we'll probably end up having people boycott conferences here or participation here because of that kind of thing too. So it's not helpful on any level. Yeah.
No argument. I don't have any trouble with the stuff the feds are doing. It's a pain in the neck, but I understand it. This version, if they'd written this law better, it wouldn't be so bad. If it was like after you'd gone through your interviews, you know, we had to do this double check of people who come from countries which are believed to be purposely and consciously stealing intellectual property or whatever, it would be easier to handle it. So the university is trying to staff up. You just did this thing before there was any support from the university, Islamic studies hires. I hope we have enough support soon that it becomes more bearable for you to examine those candidates and not something that looks like an impossibility. And that's an attempt to mitigate this, this law that we have to live with. And it drives me crazy because somebody in Islamic studies is not stealing intellectual property from some electrical engineer who's doing work for, I don't know what, some US agency. So it's a little annoying. The brush is a little broad here.
Okay.
So Sherry wants to correct what I said.
Well, no, but I'm not correct what you said, but just some a sliver, a small sliver of good news in that regard is that the Board of Governors, which is charged with coming up with a regulation for this, has been in constant communication with the universities, and they have determined, and I think they have now a draft regulation circulating, that these background checks do not apply at the initial, at the interview stage. They apply when you are getting ready to extend an offer to someone. So that does help just a tiny bit, because you're right, we couldn't, there was just no way to possibly run a search if you couldn't even interview someone before doing all these extensive background checks. So.
Thanks, Sherry. I didn't realize they were doing that. That does help quite a lot. That's a lot better.
Okay. Any follow-up before I move on here? Okay, now to get to the COVID-19 part of the agenda. So to give you context on this first question, what has come to us, and this has been throughout the time of vaccinations, is from parents and people who have loved ones who, for whatever reason, can't get vaccinated, or at least can't get vaccinated by the time the fall semester starts. And so that's what they're talking about as far as family loopholes go. So, you know, we could, you know, anybody in the bargaining unit can be vaccinated, come to campus, but then they might have one or more family members at home who, for whatever reason, can't get vaccinated come August 22nd or whatever it is, fall semester starts, and might leave their family members vulnerable. So that's what we're meaning by these vaccination loopholes.
Yeah, I understand. You know, here's a case where I don't know that I have anything very positive in response to this question. As you know, and we know, that people can individually get vaccines and they're pretty effective. They were very effective. Now they're, I would say, pretty effective with the variants that are coming out. An individual is reasonably protected. Even if they catch a variant, they're very unlikely to have a serious case or end up in the hospital or with severe condition or death. Nothing is ever zero. And your concern, I understand, is somebody perhaps who's been vaccinated nonetheless contracting COVID, taking it home and risking a family member. And what I will say is that we've been able to extend our the health-based reason for accommodations, which was really not extending at all to an individual's personal high-risk circumstances, at least to that, over the course of the summer. Our Office of Institutional Equity, which does these things, which has the staff that accept applications for ADA accommodations, follows pretty closely guidelines from some federal agencies. And in the spring, it was restricted to the same conditions that were ordinarily taken into account for accommodations. And they said very explicitly that vulnerability to an infection was not one of those conditions, which was a basis. Well, I've forgotten the right terminology, but the life-limiting circumstances, which are the basis in law for an accommodation. And the guidance from the federal agencies changed. They reached back to the people who had been denied and told them that they would get accommodations with a sufficient documentation of these circumstances from their medical provider. So that was a step in this direction. I don't believe we will or will be able to extend that to the circumstance that you're describing here, Robert, of people who have a family member or a household member who will remain vulnerable. The best we'll be able to say is, of course, do get vaccinated. If you have a particular reason for continued concern beyond that, consider wearing a mask, consider being careful about spacing in what you do outside your classroom. in your classroom.
Why can't we consider that? I didn't get that. Why can't we consider people's life circumstances?
Sorry, I lost my grip on who was asking.
Claudia.
Sorry, Claudia. Hi. For some reason, it didn't flash on me. So we're not considering those circumstances. We've tried to maintain.
But I guess the question is why, since they are clearly preventing people from being able to do their job, are forcing some people to quit their job, are adding to a public health risk. Why is the university simply saying, we're not going to look at that?
You know, I guess the real statement, the fundamental statement is that we can't eliminate risks and continue to do business. We haven't got the ability to meet our responsibility to our students as a public agency and eliminate all risk for all of our employees and all of their families. That's our institutional leadership belief in any event, Claudia. And it opens a door which is almost ends up with a close to unlimited number of people able to walk through it. That is to say, we think we will be unable to offer the courses that our students need in the coming year if we start to have many, many and too many of our classes, for example, back to remote teaching. And it's a really kind of an odd circumstance to be part of a public system, not an entirely independent institution. The whole SUS has been seeking to walk together throughout the pandemic. We've been obligated to walk together throughout the pandemic. The presidents working with the Board of Governors got us to the point that you all saw at the beginning of the pandemic and during the last year. And at this point, collectively, the decision of the SUS is what I've just described, that we're going to be offering classes much like normal, that we can't have large numbers of classes moving away, that we can't have large numbers of employees stepping back from the workplace.
Just as a one quick follow-up, I hear that that's your belief and that that's the belief of the SUS folks more generally. I guess one question, since you're an empirical guy, do you have any evidence that there are such a great number of faculty who have family members who are at risk at home and who would need this accommodation? Has there been a survey? Is there some kind of evidence that this would actually be disruptive to operations of the university?
And more anecdotal, Claudia.
So could we persuade you to be more than anecdotal? Possibly do a survey? Because, I mean, if we're talking about the young children issue, right, which I would think might be a majority of the people we're speaking about, I mean, that's going to be mitigated at least by October 1st, right? Isn't that when young children will be able to get vaccinated?
We're talking about people who have children at home or are taking care of some elders who cannot, or people who are cancer survivors who cannot be vaccinated, for example, at this point. But in the absence of having any kind of indication of how many people these are, I find it quite callous, frankly, to simply say we're not going to look at these situations. So minimally having some evidence that there are this many people who would need these accommodations and who would ask for these accommodations, and therefore we can do it, that would be a different conversation than simply starting by saying, no, we're not going to do it. So it's, as you can imagine, quite troubling to hear that it's based on anecdotal evidence and a belief shared across the state.
Oh, I hear you. The rest of our story is that we are bound to follow the advice of the public health establishment of the county and of the state. And the guidance that we've received is that the risk that you're talking about and that you fear and we fear is very small. The risk of what a vaccinated, especially a vaccinated masked person, contracting a virus, having a sufficient viral load to be infectious, even to unvaccinated or immune suppressed people, is very small. Very small never means zero. And so how people weigh that, I will just say, really depends on your circumstance.
And I think when the Delta variant, as it is currently taking off in Florida, those things might change again, those predictions of what's more or less dangerous, yeah. I think.
I cannot argue with that. We've been able to, you know, adjust in the past when circumstances changed. I trust we'll be able to do so again if it looks like it's necessary for fall. So the best I can say is not at this time.
So I guess that leads us to the next question, Provost Johnson. So are there any specific plans or any conversations being made in regards to the Delta variant internally?
So it's actually the same as everything associated with COVID. I mean, it's not specific to the variants. It's what's the case number and what's the danger? What's the advice from the public health people? And when should something change? You know, we were required to eliminate masking and we're not permitted to have vaccine requirements. So it's really important to be persuasive to our community to have as many people get vaccinated as possible. And we're doing so aggressively with our student body. You don't see that very much because those are messages that go to our students. It will become more visible as the fall actually begins. You know, our student government wants to have a big competition with USF over who can have the highest rate of vaccination among the students. We will have drives for our students. We're hoping to have giveaways. Orange County may bring their mobile sites as well as the things that we have available in student health to get the percentage up to the point where we prevent runaway infection so that it remains at a modest level in the community. That's today's plan. Will that be a sufficiently strong plan, let's say 4 weeks from now, as the semester starts to get closer? I couldn't tell you. Last year, 4 weeks before the semester started, I had a similar feeling. I simply didn't know whether our, at that point, you may recall, we didn't know if we were able to get enough supplies for our what then seemed to be most important matters of cleaning, masks for people on campus and the like. So we think we're prepared for it and prepared to change if need be. We're assuredly much better than we were in terms of understanding the steps to take and close contact with the public health people in Orange County and the state. That's the best I can tell you right now. And it's not so much specifically about the variant, it's the fact that it's the variant, which is the COVID expression at this time. It's the same set of concerns. I mean, we are continuing certain things, you know, the testing of wastewater, the testing and tracing, the COVID line that we want people to call when there's any issue associated with an infection or exposure. And we'll re-communicate about all of these as it gets closer to the start of the semester. So some things we've stopped, some things we couldn't continue, other things we are continuing, tracing especially, COVID line and testing.
So
I'll just say there's a few more, I'm sorry, Robert, just to say it, there's a few more things, right? We worked on the HVAC systems in a lot of the buildings because there's been a greater recognition about the need for air turnover in internal spaces, something that was really not understood by virtually anybody a year ago at this time. That's not something we were thinking about as last fall approached. And that's largely been done in our buildings now. Sorry, Robert.
No, I was just going to give you the opportunity because I think you've answered at least partly the next two questions. So if there's something you feel left out, if we can get to that. I'm assuming, you know, based on just what you just said, there are some contingency plans in case COVID rates go up in the fall, that you have some kind of measures in place or a plan in place to respond to that, right?
Well, we still have the ability to have more classes remote, something we've been discouraged from doing. That'll be something that we do SUS-wide, or at least there'll be an SUS-wide understanding that that's become necessary if it becomes necessary. And it's in response to changing conditions.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of what you said. So what you're saying is we could return to like virtual if the ground
if it really shifts under us in a really bad way, that becomes possible, or maybe a partial return to that. You know, I don't know what a partial return means. Is it that we seek to have some of our largest classes remote? Who knows? At this moment, if there's not a plan that says, here's what we're going to do, but, you know, it's more of a, let's watch what happens and see if it's getting worse and worse, or if it's hit a point where it's turning back over. I have to answer one of the questions here in a second that's on the list. But curiously enough, I have some hope that this summer, this week's takeoff of COVID, presumably the Delta variant in Florida, including Central Florida, shocked some people who haven't gotten around to getting a vaccine. I mean, right, there's three kinds of people, those who can't and shouldn't get vaccinated, and the rest of us should be taking care of them. Those who, and this would have described me as a 20-year-old, haven't bothered to do anything about it because it doesn't seem like a risk to me. And those who are stubbornly opposed to doing so for reasons that make sense to them. We're not sure what effect we can have on the stubbornly opposed group. We need to make certain that everybody on the fence, we make it as easy as possible and make them see the significance of taking action. And it's, you know, we can hope that this little shock about an increase in the vicinity of the school where they're all intending to continue their or start their education this fall shocks more of the fence sitters into action. And we'll certainly try to help that shock take place and persuade them to do so and make it easy.
So with the fall return, are you taking any other measures to keep people safe on campus? For example, will you still continue to offer free masks to those who might wish them?
I don't know the answer to the free masks. I know that we're keeping the hand sanitizers everywhere and filled. I know that they're not intending to keep going with the wipes near the classrooms, that they weren't used and they basically just dry out in place. And it turns out that was based on a theory that has been not very well borne out about transmission. It's much more airborne than surface-borne. People should wash their hands. So we'll continue with those efforts, wash hands and sterilizers. But as I said, we work towards improving airflow, which seems to be the more significant point. What else? I don't know about
making masks available. Like you gave question.
Janet, do you happen to know that one? We'll find that one out, Robert.
Because presumably we have new students coming in and they didn't have the opportunity to get their free mask that had UCF branding on it. That would be a really nice way to welcome them to campus to say, here, have your branded mask.
It encourages the use of masks. We did it last fall, not so much to encourage the use. Actually, we had mandated, as you'll recall, it was because masks were really hard to find at that point. We were trying to make sure that everybody could get at least one. At this point, I'm sure everybody has millions. So the real point would be as another vehicle to encourage the behavior we want to encourage. So, you know, I agree with you. It's a good thing to do.
So I guess you're all going to talk about it then.
Yeah. Your last question on this topic was about protecting mask wearers. Any answers?
Well, we had the tracking vaccination. I mean, there's some of us that wonder if there's, because I think we've heard that there's some tracking going on that's voluntary, if you could clarify that.
So what do I know? I know some things, and then there's some things I think I've heard, right? So let me distinguish them. What I know is that we were able for a time to learn the vaccination status of certain groups of students, like those moving into campus housing for summer B. We were able to maintain something like what we had done in the beginning of the summer and even last fall when the housing occupancy rate was lower. So at the beginning of summer B, we asked students whether they were vaccinated. If they were vaccinated, they didn't have to do certain things. They wouldn't have to be part of random testing. They didn't have to be tested at move-in, for example. And so they got some percentage of vaccinations from that group. And as I recall, it was somewhere in the 60s%. I think that's right. And then the nursing students, because they needed those who were going to go to certain clinics for their training, the nursing program was able to ask them, you know, what are your vaccination rate? And they were roughly 2/3 of them before they had gotten here were already vaccinated. So that was mildly, both of those were mildly encouraging. We are told that we can't survey people about their vaccination rate. I don't quite understand why. It has to do with a state law and the governor's directives. So you have noticed that you've not received a survey, you nor any of our other employees about vaccines. We just keep continuing to try to encourage people to do it. At one point, we had every intention of saying, if you're vaccinated, you don't need to do certain things, like do the self-checker, be a person selected for random testing, and it's clear we can no longer do those things. That's all part of the we can't press people to be vaccinated statement from the state government. So the only thing that I've seen held out for us, and I'll pause in a minute to see if somebody else here knows this better than I, is that if we get if Orange County starts to become interested in this part of the county as a potential area of lower vaccination rates than other parts of the county, they can come in and do things, the public health department, including checking vaccination rates more directly, as well as having drives. So I believe that prospect is still on the table.
Okay. Shelley?
I guess I'm not understanding why we can't do it. Going back to the rhetoric from earlier in this meeting about our responsibility to research and to knowledge, wouldn't this fall within our domain that we have a responsibility to collect this kind of information?
That's an interesting way.
I mean, we did when people were getting tested before they came on campus, right? Like, yeah. And I believe that hotline's still open, right? Like,
sure. No, the hotline is there. That's all self-reporting. It's not or questions, right? I think I was exposed. What do I do? Kind of question. Or I've been tested and I'm ill. Or I have symptoms. What do I do? The hotline is there, and we'll be advertising it again. That's really important.
But they're doing contact tracing, right?
And they're doing contact
tracing. Still they're doing contact tracing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But that's not the same as a survey of the general population to ask, are you vaccinated? I suspect a researcher could do that for a real research-based question, but we're a state agency. And pretending it's a research question when it's really seeking to ignore the directives from the state government is really not something that's within our ability to do.
And that is because the guidance from the state government is explicitly that we're not allowed to ask?
That's my understanding. Yeah, I'm no happier about that than you can imagine.
Yeah, I understand.
Because this is, does feel like a basically responsible thing to do, doesn't it?
All right.
And it's conceivable that the SUS as a whole will come to a different conclusion over the weeks if rates take off.
Okay.
I guess I would encourage you to think about this in the same way you're thinking about the critical race theory question, which is that we have a responsibility and that there are ways to do this that are not necessarily a fight with the state, but to figure out and strategize around how to do this as part of our educational and research mission.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to really think on that, Shelley. Is there a way? Thank you.
Okay. So now we'll get to the mask wearing, social distancing, and bullying question.
Yeah. Of all of the questions, this is the only one I think is easy. Okay. Because this just falls within our conduct policy. You know, we won't have police going around looking for, you know, bad treatment to those wearing masks. But this is, you know, it violates the student code of conduct. It violates the employee code of conduct. But what we'll need is for people to turn people in who misbehave, to register complaints so we can take action.
An information campaign is in order too, that
yeah,
these behaviors can fall under this category. Because I think you all did it recently with something else. You Might have been the, it was on the FTCL website with the syllabus that if someone does something with a recording, it could possibly trigger a code of conduct violation.
Right.
It'll so maybe be, some, that'll something be like this is in order.
Yeah. Thank you. I get that. I get that.
All right. Great. Down to our last two questions, unless someone had a follow-up with us. No? Okay. This is on the course modalities offered in the fall, and if any are being dropped or added. I know some of the stuff has shifted in the last year, so if you can update us on this.
Yeah, really, the best thing I can say is that I can't ever quite retain the explanation, actually, of the attributes. What are they calling them? Yeah, the course attributes. It's an attempt to make it possible for students to understand what the format for their class will be. And it was an attempt to capture something we didn't used to do, which are things like certain things in your class being done remotely, but not as part of web-based instruction, right? At one point, we had this simple notion that we had face-to-face classes, we had web-based classes, and we had mixed mode classes. And then it's like, well, the part of mixed mode, which isn't on campus, perhaps it's web-based, or perhaps it's something like this, something Zoom-based. Perhaps it's asynchronous recorded lectures. And so the attributes are seeking to let students know precisely how the course is going to be offered in terms of modality or modalities. I can't explain them. I know that there's a simple chart on the CDL website, which frankly I have to refer to each time I'm trying to think about this. And so I'd say just take a fast look at that. So what we're trying to do is capture some of the things that people learned during this past year and let students know if the faculty are using some of those tools in their classes this coming year.
So are any being dropped? Because we had heard one modality is being dropped since the pandemic.
Which one, Robert?
I think it's whatever was the hybrid one, maybe. Like it might be getting renamed. That could be.
I think it's a renaming. I think it's a reshaping of how it's described in terms of attributes. Because really, there's no way we're dropping that. You know, that is, in some of the studies, a better modality than either face-to-face or purely remote. So it's something that CDL tries to encourage, not discourage.
Okay. Any follow-up here from anybody? Okay, fine.
Oh, sorry, Robert.
No, go ahead, Christina.
Yeah, I'm wondering if what the process is for requesting one of those modalities and if there is any limitations to using a virtual modality, for example.
Sure. I mean, yes, there's a limitation. If a class has been scheduled face-to-face, we can't switch it to fully remote. It goes back to the conversation I had earlier. This is a case where a little longer, Central University, meaning me, is standing in the way of local decision making, okay, for the reasons I said earlier. But except for that, just talk to your chair and say, here's what I want to do. And then you can request some degree of modality change. If it ends up being a hybrid thing, which is, I don't know about this, Jana, what happens if somebody's face-to-face class, they want to turn it into something which is sort of hybrid at this point? What's your take on that?
They've been coming up through the scheduler, so the registrar's office, and it's usually thinking about what the history of the class offering has been. So is this a class that historically has been offered in a remote or online format? Is it historically always been offered face-to-face? What's the reason? Right now we're about, I think, 6 weeks out, give or take, from the fall semester. So changes now, I mean, students already have leases coming in, so it's a little more difficult to make changes at the last minute. Occasionally someone comes in and says, there's a really good pedagogical reason. Those might get a second look. Most of it's handled by the schedulers with the registrar's office, but the ones that are more complicated come up through them to us.
the way to make the request if you want to do something isn't directly to the registrar's office.
It's no, it's through the chairs.
So then it seems like a virtual remote Zoom is not really an option because none of our classes were taught in that format in 2019.
Yeah, I don't know if it's zero option, but we're not changing classes to remote Zoom now, Christina. I don't know if some were scheduled that way for the back in March as people set up the schedule for fall. Okay. If there were, that's fine. But we're not switching face-to-face classes to virtual remote.
Do you anticipate that restriction being less in the future?
Someday.
Okay.
We'll know that it's being done for pedagogical reasons.
Right.
And then I'm much less interested in having central control over that. Much more interested in going back to chairs and their faculty and their deans if necessary, thinking through what's the best way for student learning. And I would just say that over and over again. It can't ever be about, and I don't think it usually is, about faculty convenience. It's, you know, what's the best way to help students succeed in this course?
Right.
And, you know, we've always relied cheerfully on faculty and chairs to make that decision. And I have stood in your way this past year and continuing to do so this fall. So that if people aren't really free to do it, I do foresee it getting back to normality. I hoped we were going to be there this fall till people started resisting vaccination and this rebound started to occur. We shall see. This is one of the tools that's available if this rebound really turns into a serious problem.
So just quickly, Provost Johnson, I got a message while we were chatting here that the RS modality is being, being eliminated. But I think that predated the pandemic. That's not one that was introduced because of the pandemic.
That's the
20% or less FaceTime in a class.
Okay.
But just so I guess a clarification.
Yeah. Wasn't that, anyway, I thought that was something business used associated with their large lectures and recorded lectures
to
a different format. I think that's what that's about.
Sure. Okay. Any final questions before we move on here? Anybody? Okay.
If I may,
go ahead, Chuck.
I'd like to add a little bit to this conversation. We happened to have a meeting yesterday afternoon with Tom Cavanaugh, the head of CDL. And one of the things that I'm going to try to do is just very quickly share a screen that is a matrix that shows the different modalities that are available for the fall and the possible attributes associated with those courses. And our understanding after talking to Tom is the RS modality will be active for the fall, that there are courses in that RS modality. And the each course may have certain attributes associated with it. That real attribute is the one that the provost was mentioning that's very common in the College of Business that they use with some of their limited attendance or reduced seat time courses. But that particular attribute is almost exclusively used by the College of Business Administration. But this is how it all fits together. And what I was able to really appreciate, I think, for the first time after talking to Tom Cavanaugh yesterday, is the modality, which talks about the mode of instruction, really talks about how the faculty member is involved in the course. And the attributes talk about how the students are expected to participate in the course. When I hear something like that, I think about a matrix. So I put this together that shows what combinations of faculty leadership and student participation there might be in those courses.
I don't understand how face-to-face is not live.
A face-to-face will be taught live. The live attribute means that it's synchronous online instruction, which is not face-to-face.
So this is thinking from the CDL perspective.
Right. So I would encourage you to look at the CDL website. You won't see this matrix here. This is something that I did for myself to better understand it and summarize what I saw there. But I would encourage everyone to look at that that website.
I mean, this is a little confusing because, like, as I understand adaptive, you don't have to teach adaptive any of those modalities. So I don't know. There's some context missing here for me to understand this chart, but it's not a big deal.
Chuck, did you want to explain what the attributes were in comparison to modality?
Well, I think the best way that I could summarize that, I think I tried to do, is the modality is how the instructor functions in the course. What is the mode of instruction by the instructor? And the attributes describe how the students participate in the course. How are they expected to participate in the course? So the modalities applies to the instructors, attributes applies to the student participation.
This is done differently on the CDL site. You might want to, I'll put the link here.
Yeah, I've got that.
Thanks, Chuck. I just looked it up. And
yeah, I see it. That's very helpful. Thanks.
Oh, we both did it. Sorry. Okay. Slow. All right. Sherry popped a hand up. No, she didn't. It's still up from before.
It's still up from before. I'm sorry. I didn't.
Okay. Anything else before we move on to the last question here? Okay. So flexibility. I know when the pandemic started, and I think several times during the first year, we were asked to be really flexible with students who had excuses. And trying to accommodate as many of them as we can in regards to COVID and COVID-based excuses. How flexible are you going to ask us to be for this coming fall?
You know, here's a July 13th answer, Robert. It gets back to watching what happens with the pandemic, right? I really don't want to press faculty to teach in a blend flex way. Unless they've already decided to do it. Last summer, as we were looking at fall, we were trying to figure out how to have classes so students could be present, they could be isolated and continue. You know, it was actually quite hard for faculty, and nearly all of them said, not all, but nearly everybody I talked to described it as a not very satisfactory experiment. And so by spring, I, for one, was trying very hard not to press hard for people to do this. Here's my take right now. Faculty have attendance policies. They deal with students who are ill. I hope they will approach it this fall the way they have traditionally done so. In some big lectures, for example, people don't have any ability to do makeups for their quizzes. They have too many students. Instead, they do some version of grade dropping, typically. Fine, do that thing. Today what I would say is have a clearly written statement about what your approach is towards illness of students in your class. Have a degree of compassion. I continue to be uncertain that this is a time where mandatory attendance makes sense. It's July 13th. We see an uptick in cases in Orange County and Florida. I don't want to press students who are ill to come to class. And so even though it's in many classes pedagogically sound to want students to attend, they do better, they learn better, they succeed at a higher rate. I'm not sure this is the fall I would do that thing. But I really don't want to press faculty to treat illness differently from a normal semester. If you require documentation for why somebody misses, do so. If you don't require documentation and you handle illness in some other fashion, please feel free to do that. This might change. I mean, this is one of the things that can go differently as the semester approaches, along with thinking about modalities or large classes. But, you know, I would say faculty should continue sort of a normal approach. I mean, one of the reasonings here is, look, the classes are face-to-face because historically we found that a sound way to teach that class. Well, it's a sound way to teach that class. Students signed up for that class to be face-to-face. If it's face-to-face, really they need to expect to be there. We may have so many students fall ill that what I've just said isn't viable. Well, let's hope we figure that out before the semester starts, if that's the case, and aren't scrambling mid-semester to adjust. But today, my statement is please have a normal approach to illness in your class. Please do it with compassion. Please reconsider, if you like, mandatory attendance policies.
So will you communicate this? Because the last messages we received as instructors was that we were required to consider COVID-19 excuses without documentation. So there may be some folks who assume that that is still the case.
I don't remember that message, but yeah.
I know we got that at least twice. I've got it. I could check back through my inbox and send them to you if you wish.
It's not too much trouble. I'd appreciate seeing the phrase. Okay. If it's hard to find, don't fret. But I hear you loud and clear.
But I think what the union would like would be, you know, this is a return to the professor's judgment.
Yes. Right?
Because I took the last as a requirement, as this is what UCF is requiring you to do. And now if we're going back to, each individual professor assessing an excuse, that's, I think you should communicate that.
Me too. Thank you. That's an August message.
I had to find the hand in this new Zoom. We are still continuing to notify faculty who are teaching face-to-face classes. So that is a version of documentation, if you will. If a student comes to you and says, I've tested positive or I've been told to isolate, you should tell them to call the COVID line because that gets them in the system, which gets the other notification. So the documentation can come to you that way. So you're not having to ask them for their health records and stuff. So.
But, you know, I was asking Jana this morning exactly which of these things are continuing, because we ended so many things. I was losing my grip on what was still here and what wasn't. And I think most faculty, especially those who've been away all summer, will feel the same. So as August hits, we need a real significant clarity about what it is we expect or hope faculty will do this fall.
Okay. Anybody have any follow-up questions here? Otherwise, we've been through the entire agenda. Okay, well, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
Robert, I'll be following up with some of these things. So,
let me thank Robert and all of you. I really appreciate hearing blunt statements. Agreement is always pleasant. Disagreement is useful. So I appreciate this time. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody.
Peace.
Not bad. Oh, the provost, he left.
Did Mike intend to leave?
You know, he might sign back in. I don't know.
He did.